statues. When the doors opened at the viewing platform, anyone inside would almost certainly be dead or dying. Even a more measured ascent would be accompanied by a great deal of discomfort. The temperature 6 miles up can be -70°F, and you would need, or at least very much appreciate, supplementary oxygen. After you have left the troposphere, the temperature soon warms up again, to about 40°F, thanks to the absorptive effects of ozone, something else de Bort discovered on his daring 1902 ascent. It then plunges to as low as -130°F in the mesosphere, before skyrocketing to 2,700°F or more in the aptly named but very erratic thermosphere, where temperatures can vary by 1,000 degrees from day to night, though it must be said that temperature at such a height becomes a somewhat notional concept. A temperature is really just a measure of the activity of molecules. At sea level, air molecules are so thick that one molecule can move only the tiniest distance, about 3/1000,000 of an inch to be precise, before banging into another. Because trillions of molecules are constantly colliding, a lot of heat gets exchanged. But at the height of the thermosphere, at 50 miles or more, the air is so thin that any two molecules will be miles apart and hardly ever come in contact. So although each molecule is very warm, there are few interactions between them, and thus little heat transference. But this is good news for satellites and spaceships, because if the exchange of heat were more efficient, any man-made object orbiting at that level would burst into flame. Even so, spaceships have to take care in the outer atmosphere, particularly on return trips to Earth, as the Space Shuttle Columbia demonstrated all too tragically in February 2003. Although the atmosphere is very thin, if a craft comes in at too steep an angle, more than about 6 degrees, or too swiftly, it can strike enough molecules to generate drag of an exceedingly combustible nature. Conversely, if an incoming vehicle hit the thermosphere at too shallow an angle, it could well bounce back into space, like a pebble skipped across water. But you needn't venture to the edge of the atmosphere to be reminded of what hopelessly ground-hugging beings we are. As anyone who has spent time in a lofty city will know, you don't have to rise too many thousands of feet from sea level before your body begins to protest. Even experienced mountaineers, with the benefits of fitness, training, and bottled oxygen, quickly become vulnerable at height to confusion, nausea, exhaustion, frostbite, hypothermia, migraine, loss of appetite, and a great many other stumbling dysfunctions. In 100 emphatic ways, the human body reminds its owner that it wasn't designed to operate so far above sea level. Even under the most favorable circumstances, the climber Peter Habler has written, of conditions atop Everest, every step at that altitude demands a colossal effort of will. You must force yourself to make every movement, reach for every handhold. You are perpetually threatened by a leaden, deadly fatigue. In The Other Side of Everest, the British mountaineer and filmmaker Matt Dickinson records how Howard Somerville, on a 1924 British expedition up Everest, found himself choking to death after a piece of infected flesh came loose and blocked his windpipe. With a supreme effort, Somerville managed to cough up the obstruction. It turned out to be the entire mucus lining of his larynx. Bodily distress is notorious above 25,000 feet, the area known to climbers as the death zone. But many people become severely debilitated, even dangerously ill, at heights of no more than 15,000 feet or so. Susceptibility has little to do with fitness. Grannies sometimes caper about in lofty situations while their fitter offspring are reduced to helpless, groaning heaps until conveyed to lower altitudes. The absolute limit of human tolerance for continuous living appears to be about 5,500 meters, or 18,000 feet. But even people conditioned to living at altitude could not tolerate such heights for long. Francis Ashcroft, in Life at the Extremes, notes that there are Andean sulfur mines at 5,800 meters, but that the miners prefer to descend 460 meters each evening and climb back up the following day, rather than live continuously at that elevation. People who habitually live at altitude have often spent thousands of years developing disproportionately large chests and lungs, increasing their density of oxygen-bearing red blood cells by almost a third, though there are limits to how much thickening with red cells the blood supply can stand. Moreover, above 5,500 meters, even the most well-adapted women cannot provide a growing fetus with enough oxygen to bring it to its full term. In the 1780s, when people began to make experimental balloon ascents in Europe, something that surprised them was how chilly it got as they rose. The temperature drops about 3 degrees Fahrenheit with every 1,000 feet you climb. Logic would seem to indicate that the closer you get to a source of heat, the warmer you would feel. Part of the explanation is that you are not really getting nearer the sun in any meaningful sense. The sun is 93 million miles away. To move a couple of thousand feet closer to it is like taking one step closer to a bushfire in Australia when you are standing in Ohio and expecting to smell smoke. The answer again takes us back to the question of the density of molecules in the atmosphere. Sunlight energizes atoms. It increases the rate at which they jiggle and jounce, and in their enlivened state they crash into one another, releasing heat. When you feel the sun warm on your back on a summer's day, it's really excited atoms you feel. The higher you climb, the fewer molecules there are, and so the fewer collisions between them. Air is deceptive stuff. Even at sea level, we tend to think of the air as being ethereal and all but weightless. In fact, it has plenty of bulk, and that bulk often exerts itself. As a marine scientist named Wyville Thomson wrote more than a century ago, "We sometimes find when we get up in the morning, by a rise of an inch in the barometer, that nearly half a ton has been quietly piled upon us during the night. But we experience no inconvenience, rather a feeling of exhilaration and buoyancy, since it requires a little less exertion to move our bodies in the denser medium. The reason you don't feel crushed under that extra half ton of pressure is the same reason your body would not be crushed deep beneath the sea. It is made mostly of incompressible fluids, which push back, equalizing the pressures within and without. But get air in motion, as with a hurricane or even a stiff breeze, and you